line between rambunctiousness and insolence was a fine one, however, and even making allowances for his unorthodox upbringing, Otsu was growing more and more dismayed with Jotaro's behavior. His demands, particularly for food, were unending. Every time they came to a food shop, he stopped dead and wouldn't budge until she'd bought him something. After buying rice crackers at Suhara, she vowed, "This is the very last time." But before they'd gone a mile farther, the crackers were gone and he was claiming to be half-starved. The next crisis was only just averted by stopping at a tea shop in Nezame for an early lunch. By the time they'd crossed another pass, he was famished again. "Look, Otsu, that shop has dried persimmons. Shouldn't we get some just to carry with us?" Pretending not to hear, Otsu rode on. When they arrived at Fukushima in Shinano Province, a place famous for the variety and abundance of its food products, it was mid-afternoon, about the time they were in the habit of having a snack. "Let's rest a while," he whined. "Please." She paid no attention. "Come on, Otsu. Let's have some of those rice cakes coated with soybean flour. The ones they make here are famous. Don't you want any?" Since he now had hold of the cow's rope, Otsu saw it was going to be difficult to get past the shop. "Haven't you had enough?" she said with annoyance. The cow, as if in secret alliance with Jotaro, stopped and began munching grass by the roadside. "All right," snapped Otsu. "If that's the way you're going to act, I'll go on ahead and tell Musashi." When she made as if to dismount, Jotaro burst into laughter, knowing perfectly well she wouldn't carry out her threat. Her bluff called, Otsu resignedly got off the cow, and together they went into the open-sided lean-to in front of the shop. Jotaro shouted an order for 2 servings, then went out to tether the cow. When he returned, Otsu said, "You shouldn't have ordered any for me. I'm not hungry."
"You don't want anything to eat?"
"No. People who eat too much turn into stupid pigs."
"Ah, I guess I'll have to eat yours too."
"You are shameless."
His mouth was too full for his ears to hear. Presently, however, he paused long enough to shift his wooden sword to his back, where it wouldn't interfere with his expanding ribs. He began eating again, but all at once stuffed the last rice cake in his mouth and bolted for the exit.
"Through already?" Otsu called after him.
She laid some money on the table and started to follow him, but he returned and roughly shoved her back inside.
"Wait," he said excitedly. "I just saw Matahachi." "You couldn't have." She turned pale. "What would he be doing around here?"
"I have no idea. Didn't you see him?
He had on a basket hat, and he was staring straight at us." "I don't believe it."
"Want me to bring him in here and prove it?"
"You'll do no such thing."
"Oh, don't worry. If anything happens, I'll go get Musashi."
Otsu's pulse was beating wildly, but realizing that the longer they stood there, the farther ahead Musashi would have gone, she got back on the cow. As they started off, Jotaro said, "I can't figure it out. Until we got to the waterfall at Magome, we were all as friendly as could be. Since then, Musashi's hardly said a word, and you haven't been talking to him either. What's the matter?"
When she said nothing, he went on.
"Why is he walking on ahead of us? Why do we sleep in different rooms now? Did you have a fight or something?"
Otsu couldn't bring herself to give him an honest answer, for she hadn't been able to give herself one. Did all men treat women the way Musashi had treated her, openly trying to force his love on her? And why had she rejected him so vehemently? Her distress and confusion now were, in a way, more painful than the illness from which she had but recently recovered. The fountain of love that had comforted her for years had suddenly turned into a raging waterfall. The memory of that other waterfall resounded in her ears, along with her own cry of distress and Musashi's angry protest. She could ask herself whether they would go on like this forever, never understanding each other, but why she was now trailing along behind him, trying not to lose sight of him, struck even her as illogical. Though out of embarrassment, they kept apart and spoke rarely, Musashi showed no signs of breaking his promise to go with her to Edo. At the Kozenji, they turned on to another road. There was a barrier at the top of the first hill. Otsu had heard that ever since the Battle of Sekigahara, government officials had been examining travelers, particularly women, on this road with great thoroughness. But Lord Karasumaru's letter of introduction worked like a charm, and they passed the checkpoint without difficulty. As they reached the last of the tea shops on the far side of the barrier, Jotaro asked, "Otsu, what does fugen mean?"
"Fugen?"
"Yeah, back there in front of a tea shop, a priest pointed at you and said, 'You looked like fugen on a cow.' What does that mean?"
"I suppose he was referring to the bodhisattva fugen."
"That's the bodhisattva that rides on an elephant, isn't it? In that case, I must be the bodhisattva monju. They're always together."
"A very gluttonous monju, I should say.
Good enough for crybaby fugen."
"Oh, you would say that.
Why are fugen and monju always together? They're not a man and a woman." Intentionally or not, he was striking close again. Having heard much about these things while she was living at the Shippoji, Otsu could have answered the question in some detail, but she replied simply, "Monju represents wisdom, fugen, devoted conduct."
"Stop!"
The voice was Matahachi's, and it came from behind them. Sick with revulsion, Otsu thought, "The coward!" She turned and stared frigidly at him. Matahachi glared back, his feelings more muddled than ever. At Nakatsugawa, it had been pure jealousy, but he'd continued to spy on Musashi and Otsu. When he saw that they were keeping apart, he interpreted this as an attempt to deceive people and imagined all sorts of scandalous goings-on when they were alone.
"Get down!" he commanded.
Otsu stared at the cow's head, unable to speak. Her feeling toward him had settled once and for all into hatred and contempt.
"Come on, woman! Get down!"
Though she burned with indignation, she spoke coldly,
"Why? I have no business with you."
"Is that so?"
he growled menacingly, taking hold of her sleeve.
"You may not have any business with me, but I have business with you. Get down!"
Jotaro let go of the rope and shouted,
"Leave her alone! If she doesn't want to get off, why should she?"
Holding his arms straight out, he butted Matahachi's chest.
"What do you think you're doing, you little bastard?"
Thrown off balance, Matahachi readjusted his feet in his sandals and raised his shoulders threateningly.
"I thought I'd seen your ugly face somewhere. You're the tramp from that sake shop in Kitano."
"Yeah, and now I know why you were drinking yourself silly. You were living with some old bitch and you didn't have the guts to stand up to her. Isn't that the truth?"
Jotaro couldn't have touched a more tender spot.
"You snot-nosed runt!"
Matachi snatched at his collar, but Jotaro ducked and came up on the other side of the cow.
"If I'm a snot-nosed runt, what does that make you? Snot-nosed oaf? Scared of a woman?"
Matachi darted around the cow, but again Jotaro slipped under the animal's belly and came up on the other side. This happened 3 or 4 times before Matahachi finally managed to latch on to the boy's collar.
"All right, just say that one more time.
Snot-nosed oaf, scared of a woman."
Jotaro's wooden sword was only half-drawn when Matahachi got a good grip and sent him sailing well away from the road into a clump of bamboo. He landed on his back in a small stream, stunned and only barely conscious. By the time he recovered enough to crawl like an eel back to the road, it was too late. The cow was loping heavily along the road, Otsu still on her back, Matahachi running ahead with the rope in his hand.
"Bastard!"
moaned Jotaro, stung by his own helplessness. Too dazed to get to his feet, he lay there fuming and cursing. On a hill a mile or so ahead, Musashi was resting his feet and idly wondering whether the clouds were moving or, as they seemed,
were permanently suspended between Mount Koma and the broad foothills below. He started, as though at some wordless communication, shook himself and straightened up. His thoughts were really on Otsu, and the more he thought, the angrier he became. Both his shame and his resentment had been washed away in the swirling basin under the falls, but as the days passed, the doubts kept coming back. Had it been wicked of him to reveal himself to her? Why had she rebuffed him, shrunk from him as though she despised him? "Leave her behind," he said out loud. Yet he knew he was only deceiving himself. He had told her that when they reached Edo, she could study what was best for her, while he followed his own path. Implicit in this was a promise for the more distant future. He had left Kyoto with her. He had a responsibility to stay with her. "What will happen to me? With two of us, what will happen to my sword?" He raised his eyes to the mountain and bit his tongue, ashamed of his pettiness. To look at the great peak was humbling. He wondered what could be keeping them and stood up. He could see the forest a mile back, but no people. Could they have been held up at the barrier? The sun would be setting soon. They should have caught up long ago. Suddenly he felt alarmed. Something must have happened. Before he knew it, he was tearing down the hill so fast that the animals in the fields scurried off in all directions. The Warrior of Kiso. Musashi had not run very far when a traveler called to him.
"Hey, weren't you with a young woman and a boy before?"
Musashi stopped abruptly.
"Yes," he said with sinking heart. "Has something happened to them?"
Apparently, he was about the only person who had not heard the story that was fast becoming common gossip along the high road. A young man had approached the girl, kidnapped her. He had been seen whipping the cow, driving her down a side road near the barrier. The traveler had barely finished repeating the tale before Musashi was on his way. Racing at top speed, he still took an hour to reach the barrier, which had closed at 6, and with it the tea shops on either side. Looking rather frantic, Musashi approached an old man who was piling up stools in front of his shop.
"What's the matter, sir? Forget something?"
"No, I'm looking for a young woman and a boy who passed here a few hours ago."
"Would that be the girl who looked like Fugen on a cow?"
"That's the one," Musashi answered, without thinking. "I'm told a ronin took her off somewhere. Do you know which way they went?"
"I didn't actually see the incident myself, but I heard they left the main road at the head burying mound. That'd take them toward Nobu Pond."
For the life of him, Musashi had no idea who might have kidnapped Otsu or why. Matachi's name never entered his mind. He imagined it might be a good-for-nothing ronin, like the ones he had encountered in Nara. Or perhaps one of the freebooters reputed to be hanging out in the woods hereabouts. He only hoped it was a petty crook rather than one of the hoodlums who made a business of abducting and selling women and were known to be vicious on occasion. He ran on and on in his search for Nobu Pond. After the sun went down, he could hardly see a foot ahead, though the stars were bright above. The road began to slope upward. He assumed he was entering the foothills of Mount Koma. Having seen nothing resembling a pond, and fearing he was on the wrong road, he stopped and looked around. In the vast sea of blackness, he was able to make out a lone farmhouse, a windbreak of trees, and looming darkly above these, the mountain. When he got closer, he saw that the house was large and sturdily built, though moss grew on the thatched roof and the thatch itself was rotting. There was a light outside, whether torch or fire he couldn't tell, and near the kitchen, a spotted cow. He was sure it was the animal Otsu had been riding. He approached stealthily, keeping to the shadows. When he was close enough to see into the kitchen, he heard a loud male voice coming from a shed on the other side of some piles of straw and firewood.
"Put up your work, mother,"
the man was saying.
"You're always complaining about your eyes being bad, but you go on working practically in the dark."
There was a fire in the hearth room next to the kitchen, and Musashi thought he heard the whir of a spinning wheel. After a moment or two, the sound stopped, and he heard someone moving about. The man came out of the shed and closed the door behind him.
"I'll be in as soon as I've washed my feet," he called. "You can go ahead and put dinner on."
He placed his sandals on a rock by a stream flowing behind the kitchen. As he sat wiggling his feet in the water, the cow put her head close to his shoulder. He rubbed her nose.
"Mother," he called, "come here a minute. I made a real find today. What do you think it is?" "It's a cow, a really fine one too."
Musashi made his way quietly past the front door of the house. Crouching on a stone beneath a side window, he looked into what turned out to be a hearth room. The first object he saw was a lance hanging from a blackened rack near the top of the wall, a fine weapon that had been polished and lovingly cared for. Bits of gold shone dully on the leather of its scabbard. Musashi did not know what to make of it. It was not the sort of thing usually found in a farmer's house. Farmers were forbidden to have weapons, even if they could afford them. The man appeared for a moment in the light of the outside fire. At a glance, Musashi knew he was no ordinary peasant. His eyes were too bright, too alert. He wore a knee-length work kimono and mud-spattered leggings. His face was round, and his bushy hair was tied in back with two or three lengths of straw. Though he was short, no more than 5'6", he was thick-chested and solidly built. He walked with firm, decisive steps. Smoke began to escape from the window. Musashi raised his sleeve to cover his face, but too late. He inhaled a lungful of smoke and couldn't stop himself from coughing.
"Who's there?"
the old woman called from the kitchen. She came into the hearth room and asked,
"Gonosuke, did you shut the shed? There seems to be a millet thief around. I heard him cough."
Musashi slipped away from the window and hid himself among the trees of the windbreak.
"Where?"
shouted Gonosuke, striding rapidly from behind the house. The old woman appeared at the little window.
"He must be right around here. I heard him cough."
"Are you sure it's not just your ears?"
"My hearing's all right, and I'm sure I saw a face at the window. The smoke from the fire must have made him cough."
Slowly, suspiciously, Gonosuke advanced 15 or 20 paces, looking carefully to right and left, as though he were a sentinel guarding a fortress.
"You may be right," he said. "I seem to smell a human being."
Taking his cue from the look in Gonosuke's eyes, Musashi bided his time. There was something about the man's posture, something that said it was best to be cautious. He seemed to be leaning slightly forward from the waist. Musashi could not make out what sort of weapon he was carrying, but when he turned, Musashi saw he had a 4-foot staff behind his back. No ordinary pole, it had the sheen of a much-used weapon and seemed to be an integral part of the man's body. There was no question in Musashi's mind but that he lived with it day in and day out and knew exactly how to use it. Moving into view, Musashi shouted,
"You, whoever you are, I've come for my companions."
Gonosuke glared silently at him.
"Give me back the woman and boy you kidnapped on the high road. If they're unharmed, we'll let it go at that. But if they've been injured, you're in for it."
The snow melt feeding the streams in this area gave the breeze a sharp edge, which somehow emphasized the silence.
"Turn them over to me, now!"
Musashi's voice bit more sharply than the wind. Gonosuke had what was called a reverse hold on his staff. His hair standing up like a hedgehog's, he straightened to his full height and shouted,
"You horse's turd! Who are you calling a kidnapper?"
"You.
You must have seen the boy and woman were unprotected, so you kidnapped them and took them here. Bring them out."
The staff came away from Gonnosuke's side in a movement so rapid Musashi could not tell where the man's arm ended and the weapon began. Musashi jumped aside. "Don't do anything you'll regret," he warned, then withdrew several paces.
"Who do you think you are, you crazy bastard?"
As Gonnosuke spat out his reply, he moved swiftly into action again, determined not to give Musashi a moment's rest. When the latter shifted 10 paces, he covered the same distance simultaneously. Twice, Musashi started to move his right hand to the hilt of his sword, but both times he stopped. During the instant when he grasped his sword, his elbow would be exposed. Musashi had seen the swiftness of Gonnosuke's staff and knew he wouldn't have time to complete the movement. He saw, too, that if he allowed himself to make light of his stocky opponent, he'd be in trouble. And if he didn't remain calm, even taking a breath could endanger him. Musashi had yet to size up his enemy, who at the moment had his legs and torso in a splendid stance of the indestructible perfect type. Musashi was already beginning to feel that this farmer had a technique superior to that of any expert swordsman he had encountered so far, and a look in his eyes suggested he had mastered that way which Musashi was forever seeking. But he had little time for assessment. Strike followed strike, almost by the second, as one curse after another poured from Gonnosuke's mouth. Sometimes he used both hands, sometimes only one, executing with flowing dexterity the overhead strike, the lateral strike, the thrust, and the shift. A sword, being distinctly divided into blade and hilt, has only one point, but either end of a staff can be applied lethally. Gonnosuke was wielding the staff with the same agility as a candy maker handling taffy. Now it was long, now short, now invisible, now high, now low, seemingly everywhere at once. From the window, the old woman urged her son to be careful.
"Gonnosuke! He doesn't look like an ordinary samurai!"
She seemed to be as involved in the fight as he was.
"Don't worry!"
The knowledge that she was watching appeared to raise Gonnosuke's fighting spirit to an even higher pitch. At this point, Musashi ducked a blow to his shoulder and in the same movement slid in close to Gonnosuke and seized his wrist. The next instant, the farmer was flat on his back, his feet kicking at the stars.
"Wait!"
shouted the mother, breaking the lattice of the window in her excitement. Her hair stood on end. She seemed thunderstruck to see her son downed. The wild look on her face kept Musashi from taking the next logical step, which would have been to whip out his sword and finish Gonnosuke off.
"All right, I'll wait,"
he shouted, straddling Gonnosuke's chest and pinning him to the ground. Gonnosuke was struggling valiantly to free himself. His legs, over which Musashi had no control, flew in the air, then crashed into the earth as he arched his back. It was all Musashi could do to keep him down. The mother came rushing out the kitchen door, screaming vituperously,
"Look at you! How did you get into a mess like that?"
But she added,
"Don't give up! I'm here to help you!"
Since she had asked Musashi to wait, he expected her to fall down on her knees and beg him not to kill her son, but a glance told him that he was sadly mistaken. She held the lance, now unsheathed, behind her, but he caught the glint of the blade, and he felt her eyes burning into his back.
"Filthy Ronin!" she cried. "Use a tricky throw, will you? You think we're nothing but dumb farmers, don't you?"
Musashi couldn't turn to ward off an attack from behind because of the way Gonnosuke was squirming about, trying to put Musashi in a position advantageous to his mother.
"Don't worry, mother," he said. "I'll make it. Don't get too close."
"Keep calm," she cautioned. "You mustn't lose to the likes of him. Remember your ancestors. What's happened to the blood you inherited from the great Kakumyo, who fought side by side with the general of Kiso?"
"I won't forget!"
yelled Gonnosuke. No sooner were the words out of his mouth than he managed to raise his head and sink his teeth into Musashi's thigh, at the same time letting go of his staff and striking Musashi with both hands. The old woman chose this moment to level the lance at Musashi's back.
"Wait!"
shouted Musashi. They had reached a stage where settlement seemed possible only through the death of one of them. If Musashi had been absolutely sure that by winning he could free Otsu and Jotaro, he would have pressed on. Now it seemed the better part of valor to call a halt and talk things over. He turned his shoulders toward the old woman and told her to put down the lance.
"What should I do, son?"
Gonnosuke was still pinned to the ground, but he was also having second thoughts. Perhaps this ronin had some reason to think his companions were here. There was no sense in risking death over a misunderstanding. Once they had disentangled themselves, it took only a few minutes to make it clear that it was all a mistake. The three of them repaired to the house and the blazing fire. Kneeling by the hearth, the mother said,
"Very dangerous to think that there was no cause for a fight to begin with."
As Gonnosuke prepared to take his place beside her, she shook her head.
"Before you sit down," she said, "take the samurai all through the house so that he can be satisfied that his friends aren't here."
Then to Musashi,
"I want you to look carefully and see for yourself."
"That's a good idea," agreed Gonnosuke. "Come with me, sir. Examine the house from top to bottom. I dislike being suspected of kidnapping."
Already seated, Musashi declined.
"It's not necessary. From what you've told me, I'm sure you had nothing to do with the kidnapping. Forgive me for accusing you." "I was partly to blame," Gonnosuke said apologetically. "I should have found out what you were talking about before I lost my temper."
Musashi then asked, somewhat hesitantly, about the cow, explaining that he was quite sure it was the one he had rented in Seta.
"I just happened to find her," replied Gonnosuke. "This evening I was down at Nobu Pond netting loaches, and on my way home I saw the cow with one leg sunk in the mud. It's swampy down there. The more she struggled, the deeper she sank. She was raising an awful rumpus, so I pulled her free. When I asked around the neighborhood, she didn't seem to belong to anybody, so I thought a thief must have stolen her and later abandoned her. A cow's worth about half a man on a farm, and this is a good one with a young udder," Gonnosuke laughed. "I sort of decided that heaven must have sent the cow to me because I'm poor and can't do anything for my mother without a little supernatural help. I don't mind giving the animal back to her owner, but I don't know who that is."
Musashi noted that Gonnosuke told the story with the simple, straightforward honesty of a person born and brought up in the country. His mother became sympathetic.
"I'm sure this ronin's worried about his friends," she said. "Eat your dinner and take him to look for them. I only hope they're somewhere near the pond. The hills are no place for strangers. They're full of bandits who'll steal anything. Horses, vegetables, anything. This whole business sounds like some of their work."
The breeze would begin as a whisper, mushroom into a violent gust, then roar through the trees and raise havoc with the smaller plants. During a lull that left only the ominous silence of the stars above, Gonnosuke held the torch high and waited for Musashi to catch up with him.
"Sorry," he said, "but nobody seems to know anything about them. There's just one more house between here and the pond. It's behind those woods over there. The owner farms part of the time and hunts the rest. If he can't help us, there's nowhere else to look."
"Thanks for going to all this trouble.
We've already been to more than 10 houses, so I suppose there's not much hope of their being around here. If we don't find out anything at this next house, let's give up and go back."
It was past midnight. Musashi had expected they would at least find some trace of Jotaro, but no one had seen him. Descriptions of Otsu had brought nothing but blank looks and long country pauses.
"If it's the walking you're thinking about, that's nothing to me. I could walk all night. Are the woman and boy servants of yours?" Brother? Sister?
They're the people closest to me. Each would have liked to ask the other more about himself, but Gonosuke lapsed into silence, moved a pace or two ahead, and guided Musashi along a narrow path toward Nobu Pond. Musashi was curious about Gonosuke's skill with the staff and how he had acquired it, but his sense of propriety kept him from asking about it. Musing that his meeting the man was due to a mishap and his own rashness, he nevertheless felt extremely grateful. What a misfortune it would have been to miss seeing this great fighter's dazzling technique.
Gonosuke stopped and said, "You'd better wait here. Those people are probably asleep, and we don't want to frighten them. I'll go alone and see if I can find out anything."
He pointed out the house, whose thatched roof seemed nearly buried in the trees. A rustling of bamboo accompanied his running footsteps. Presently, Musashi heard him knocking loudly on the door. He returned a few minutes later with a story that seemed to give Musashi his first real lead. It had taken him a while to make the man and his wife understand what he was asking about, but finally the wife told him of something that had happened to her that afternoon. A little before sundown, on her way home from shopping, the woman had seen a boy running toward Yabuhara, hands and face covered with mud and a long wooden sword in his obi. When she stopped him and asked what was wrong, he responded by asking her where the office of the shogun's deputy was. He went on to tell her that a bad man had carried off the person he was traveling with. She advised him that he was wasting his time. The shogun's officers would never on their own organize a search for a person of no consequence. If it was somebody great or important, or if they had orders from above, they would turn every dollop of horse manure, every grain of sand, but they had no use for common folk. Anyway, for a woman to be kidnapped or a traveler to be stripped clean by highwaymen was nothing unusual. Things like that happened morning, noon, and night. She had told the boy to go past Yabuhara to a place called Narai. There, at an intersection it was easy to see, he would find a wholesale house dealing in herbs. It was owned by a man named Daizo, who would listen to his story and in all likelihood offer to help him. Unlike the officials, Daizo not only sympathized with the weak, but would go to great lengths to help them if he thought their cause was worthy. Gonosuke ended by saying,
"It sounded to me as though the boy was Jotaro. What do you think?"
"I'm sure of it," said Musashi.
"I suppose the best thing to do would be to go to Narai as quickly as possible and look up this man Daizo. Thanks to you, I at least have an idea what to do." "Why not spend the rest of the night at my house? You can start out in the morning after you've had some breakfast."
"May I do that?"
"Sure. If we cross Nobu Pond, we can get home in less than half the time it took us to get here. I asked the man, and he said we could use his boat."
The pond, at the end of a short downhill walk, looked like a gigantic drumhead. Encircled by purple willow trees, it must have been 1,200 or 1,300 yards in diameter. The dark shadow of Mount Koma was reflected in the water, along with a sky full of stars. With Musashi holding the torch and Gonosuke poling, they slid silently across the middle of the pond. Far redder than the torch itself was its reflection in the smooth water. Poisonous Fangs. From a distance, the torch and its reflection suggested a pair of firebirds swimming across the serene surface of Nobu Pond.
"Somebody coming," whispered Matahachi. "All right, we'll go this way," he said, tugging at the rope he had tied Otsu with. "Come on."
"I'm not going anywhere,"
protested Otsu, digging in her heels.
"Stand up."
With the end of the rope, he lashed her across the back, then lashed and lashed again. But every stroke reinforced her resistance. Matahachi lost heart.
"Come on now," he implored. "Please, walk."
When she still refused to stand, his anger flared again, and he seized her by the collar.
"You'll come whether you like it or not!"
Otsu tried to turn toward the pond and scream, but he quickly gagged her with a hand towel. Eventually, he managed to drag her to a tiny shrine hidden among the willows. Otsu, yearning to have her hands free to attack her abductor, thought how wonderful it would be to be transformed into a snake, like the one she could see painted on a plaque. It was coiled around a willow, hissing at a man who was putting a curse on it.
"That was lucky."
Sighing with relief, he pushed her into the shrine and leaned heavily against the outside of the grill door, intently watching the little boat coast into an inlet some 400 yards away. His day had been totally exhausting. When he'd tried to use brute force to take her, she'd made it clear she'd rather die than submit. She'd even threatened to bite off her tongue, and Matachi knew her well enough to know it was no empty threat. His frustration brought him to the verge of committing murder, but the very notion sapped his strength and cooled his lust. He couldn't fathom why she loved Musashi instead of him, when it had, for so long, been the other way around. Didn't women prefer him to his old friend? Hadn't they always? Hadn't Oko been immediately drawn to Matahachi when they'd first met her? Of course she had. Only one explanation was possible. Musashi was slandering him behind his back. Pondering his betrayal, Matahachi worked himself into a fury.
"What a stupid, gullible ass I am! How could I have let him make such a fool of me? To think I was in tears listening to him talk about undying friendship, about how he treasured it! Ha!"
He upbraided himself for ignoring Sasaki Kojiro's warning, which resounded in his ears. "Trust that scoundrel Musashi, and you'll live to regret it." Until today, he'd wavered between liking and disliking his childhood friend, but now he loathed him. And although he couldn't bring himself to voice it, a solemn prayer for Musashi's eternal damnation took form in his heart. He had become convinced that Musashi was his enemy, born to thwart him at every turn and eventually destroy him.
"The lousy hypocrite," he thought. "He sees me after such a long time and starts preaching about being a real human being. Tells me to buck up, that we'll go on from here hand in hand, friends for life. I remember every word, can see him saying it all so sincerely. It makes me sick just to think about it. He was probably laughing to himself the whole time. The so-called good people of this world are all phonies like Musashi," he reassured himself. "Well, I see through them now. They can't fool me anymore. Studying a lot of silly books and putting up with all sorts of hardship just to become another hypocrite is nonsense. From now on, they can tell me whatever they please. If I have to be a villain to do it, one way or another, I'll stop that bastard from making a name for himself. For the rest of his life, I'll stand in his way."
He turned around and kicked the grill door in. Then he untied her gag and said coldly,
"Still crying, are you?"
She did not answer.
"Answer me! Answer the question I asked you before!"
Enraged by her silence, he kicked her dark form on the floor. She moved out of range and said,
"I have nothing to say to you. If you're going to kill me, do it like a man."
"Don't talk like a fool. I've made up my mind. You and Musashi have ruined my life, and I'm going to get even, no matter how long it takes."
"That's nonsense. Nobody led you astray but you yourself. Of course, you may have had a little help from that Okol woman."
"Watch what you're saying."
"Oh, you and your mother. What is it about your family? Why do you always have to go around hating somebody?"
"You talk too much. What I want to know is, are you going to marry me or not?"
"I can answer that question easily."
"Well, answer then."
"Throughout this lifetime and the eternal future, my heart is bound to one man, Miyamoto Musashi. How can I possibly care for anyone else, let alone a weakling like you? I hate you."
A trembling swept over his body. With a cruel laugh, he said,
"So you hate me, do you? Well, that's too bad, because whether you like me or not, from this night on, your body is mine."
Otsu shook with anger.
"You still want to be difficult about it?"
"I was brought up in a temple. I never saw my father or mother. Death doesn't frighten me in the least."
"Are you joking?"
he growled, as he dropped to the floor beside her and pressed his face toward hers.
"Who said anything about death? Killing you wouldn't give me any satisfaction. This is what I'm going to do."
Seizing her shoulder and her left wrist, he sank his teeth right through her sleeve and into her upper arm. Screaming and writhing about, she tried to free herself, but only tightened the hold of his teeth on her arm. He did not release her even when blood dribbled down to the wrist he was holding. Face stark white, she fainted from the pain. Feeling her body grow limp, he let go and hastily forced open her mouth to make sure she hadn't actually bitten off her tongue. Her face was bathed in sweat.
"Otsu!"
he wailed.
"Forgive me!"
He shook her until she came to. The moment she was able to speak, she stretched out full length and groaned hysterically.
"Oh, it hurts! It hurts so! Jotaro! Jotaro! Help me!"
Matahachi, pale and gasping for breath, said,
"Does it hurt? Too bad. Even after it heals, the mark of my teeth will be there for a long time. What'll people say when they see that? What'll Musashi think? I put that there as a brand, so everyone'll know that one of these days you'll belong to me. If you want to run away, run. But you'll never stop being reminded of me."
In the dark shrine, slightly hazy with dust, the silence was broken only by Otsu's sobbing.
"Stop blubbering. It gets on my nerves. I'm not going to touch you, so just be quiet. Do you want me to bring you some water?"
He took an earthen bowl from the altar and started to go out. He was surprised to see a man standing outside looking in. When the man took to his heels, Matachi bounded through the door and grabbed him. The man, a farmer on his way to the wholesale market in Shiojiri with several sacks of grain packed on his horse's back, fell at Matahachi's feet, quaking with terror.
"I wasn't going to do anything. I just heard a woman crying and looked in to see what happened."
"Is that so? Are you sure?"
His manner was as stern as a local magistrate's.
"Yes, I swear it is."
"If that's the case, I'll let you off alive. Take those sacks off the horse's back and tie the woman on it. Then you'll stay with us until I'm through with you."
His fingers played menacingly with his sword hilt. The farmer, too frightened to disobey, did as he was told, and the three of them started off. Matahachi picked up a bamboo stick to use as a whip.
"We're going to Edo, and we don't want any company, so stay away from the main road," he ordered. "Take a road where we won't run into anybody."
"That's very difficult."
"I don't care how difficult it is. Take a back road. We'll go to Ina, and from there to Koshu without using the main highway."
"But that means climbing a very bad mountain path from Ubagami to Gombe Pass."
"All right, start climbing. And don't try any tricks, or I'll split your skull open. I don't particularly need you. All I want is the horse. You should be thankful I'm taking you along."
The dark path seemed to get steeper with every step. By the time they reached Ubagami, about halfway up, both men and horse were ready to drop. Beneath their feet, clouds billowed like waves. A faint trace of light tinged the eastern sky. Otsu had ridden all night without uttering a word, but when she saw the rays of the sun, she said quietly,
"Matachi, please let the man go. Give him back his horse. I promise not to run away."
Matahachi was reluctant, but she repeated her plea a third and a fourth time, and he gave in. As the farmer went away, Matahachi said to Otsu,
"Now you just come along quietly, and don't try to escape."
She placed her hand over the injured arm, and biting her lip said,
"I won't. You don't think I want anyone to see the marks of your venomous fangs on me, do you?
A maternal warning.
Mother, said Gonnosuke, you're going too far. Can't you see I'm upset too?
He was weeping, and the words came in spurts.
Shh, you'll wake him.
His mother's voice was soft but stern. She might have been scolding a 3-year-old.
If you feel so bad, the only thing to do is get a firm grip on yourself and follow the way with all your heart. Crying won't do any good. Besides, it's unbecoming. Wipe your face.
First promise you'll forgive me for that shameful performance yesterday.
Well, I couldn't help scolding you, but I suppose, after all, it's a matter of skill. They say the longer a man goes without facing a challenge, the weaker he becomes. It's only natural you lost.
Hearing that from you makes it all the worse. After all your encouragement, I still lost. I see now I don't have the talent or spirit to be a real warrior. I'll have to give up the martial arts and be content with being a farmer. I can do more for you with my hoe than I can with my staff.
Musashi was already awake. He sat straight up, amazed that the young man and his mother had taken the skirmish so seriously. He himself had already brushed it off as a mistake on his part, as well as Gonnosuke's.
What a sense of honor, he mumbled, as he crept quietly into the next room.
He went to the far side and put his eye to the crack between the shoji panels. Faintly lit by the rising sun, Gonnosuke's mother was seated with her back to the Buddhist altar. Gonnosuke was kneeling meekly before her, his eyes downcast and his face streaked with tears. Grabbing the back of his collar, she said with vehemence,
"What did you say? What's this about spending your life as a farmer?"
Pulling him closer until his head rested on her knees, she continued in an outraged tone,
"Only one thing's kept me going all these years, the hope that I could make a samurai of you and restore our family's good name. So I had you read all those books and learn the martial arts. And that's why I've managed to live all these years on so little. And now you say you're going to throw it all away?"
She too began to weep.
"Since you let him get the best of you, you have to think of vindicating yourself. He's still here. When he wakes up, challenge him to another bout. That's the only way you can regain your self-confidence."
Gonnosuke, lifting his head, said sadly,
"If I could do that, Mother, I wouldn't feel the way I do now."
"What's the matter with you? You're not acting like yourself. Where's your spirit?"
"Last night, when I went with him to the pond, I kept my eye open for a chance to attack him, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. I kept telling myself he was only a nameless ronin. Still, when I took a good look at him, my arm refused to move."
"That's because you're thinking like a coward."
"What of it? Look, I know I've got the blood of a Kiso samurai in me. I haven't forgotten how I prayed before the god of Ontake for 21 days.
Didn't you swear before the god of Ontake that you'd use your staff to create your own school?"
"Yes, but I guess I've been too complacent. I haven't considered that other men know how to fight too. If I'm as immature as I showed myself to be yesterday, how could I ever establish a school of my own? Rather than live in poverty and see you hungry, it'd be better to break my staff in half and forget about it."
"You've never lost before, and you've had a number of matches. Maybe the god of Ontake intended yesterday's defeat as a lesson to you. Maybe you're being punished for being overconfident. Giving up the staff to take better care of me isn't the way to make me happy. When that ronin wakes up, challenge him. If you lose again, then's the time to break your staff and forget your ambitions."
Musashi went back to his room to give the matter some thought. If Gonnosuke challenged him, he'd have to fight. And if he fought, he knew he'd win. Gonnosuke would be crushed, his mother heartbroken.
"There's nothing to do but avoid it," he concluded. Noiselessly sliding open the door to the veranda, he went out. The morning sun spilled a whitish light through the trees. In the corner of the yard near a storehouse stood the cow, grateful for another day and for the grass growing at her feet. Bidding the animal a silent farewell, Musashi went through the windbreak and strode off on a path winding through the fields. Mount Koma today was visible from top to bottom. The clouds were countless, small and cottony, each of a different shape, all playing freely in the breeze. Jotaro's young, Otsu frail, he told himself. But there are people who have the goodness of heart to take care of the young and the frail. Some power in the universe will decide whether I find them or not. His spirit, in turmoil since that day at the waterfall, had seemed in danger of losing its way. Now it returned to the path it was meant to follow. On a morning like this, thinking solely of Otsu and Jotaro seemed short-sighted, no matter how important they were to him. He must keep his mind on the way he had sworn to follow throughout this life and into the next. Narai, which he reached a little after noon, was a thriving community. One shop displayed a variety of pelts outside, another specialized in kiso combs. With the intention of asking his way, Musashi stuck his head into a shop that sold medicine made from bear's gall. There was a sign reading, "The Big Bear," and by the entrance, a large bear in a cage. The proprietor, his back turned, finished pouring himself a cup of tea and said, "Can I help you?" "Could you tell me how to find the store belonging to a man named Daizo?"
"Daizo? He's down at the next crossroads."
The man came out, holding his cup of tea, and pointed down the road. Catching sight of his apprentice returning from an errand, he called,
"Here, this gentleman wants to go to Daizo's place. He might not recognize it, so you'd better take him there."
The apprentice, whose head was shaved so as to leave one shock of hair in front and another in back, but none on top, marched off with Musashi in tow. The latter, grateful for the kindness, reflected that Daizo must enjoy the respect of his fellow townsmen.
"Over there," said the boy.
He pointed at the establishment on the left and immediately took his leave. Musashi, having expected a shop like the ones catering to travelers, was surprised. The grilled display window was 18 feet long, and behind the shop there were two storehouses. The house, which was large and appeared to extend quite a way back from the high wall enclosing the rest of the compound, had an imposing entranceway, now closed. With a certain hesitancy, Musashi opened the door and called, "Good day!" The large, dim interior reminded him of the inside of a sake brewery. Because of the dirt floor, the air was pleasantly cool. A man stood in front of a bookkeeper's cabinet in the office, a room with a raised floor covered with tatami. Shutting the door behind him, Musashi explained what he wanted. Before he finished, the clerk nodded and said,
"Well, well, so you've come for the boy."
He bowed and offered Musashi a cushion.
"I'm sorry to say you've just missed him. He showed up around midnight while we were preparing for the master's trip. Seems the woman he was traveling with was kidnapped, and he wanted the master to help find her. The master told him he'd be glad to try, but he couldn't guarantee anything. If she'd been taken by a freebooter or a bandit from around here, there'd be no problem. Apparently, though, it was another traveler, and he'd be sure to stay off the main roads. This morning, the master sent people out to look, but they didn't find any clues. The boy broke down when he heard that, so the master suggested he come along with him. Then they could look for her on the way, or they might even run into you. The boy seemed eager to go, and they left shortly after that. I guess it's been about 4 hours now. What a shame you missed them."
Musashi was disappointed, though he wouldn't have been in time even if he had started earlier and traveled faster. He consoled himself with the thought that there was always tomorrow.
"Where's Daizo going?" he asked. "It's hard to say. We don't run a shop in the ordinary sense.
The herbs are prepared in the mountains and brought here. Twice a year, spring and fall, the salesmen stock up here and go out on the road. Since the master doesn't have much to keep him busy, he often takes trips, sometimes to temples or shrines, sometimes to hot spring resorts, other times to places famous for their scenery. This time, I suspect he'll go to the Zenkoji, travel around Echigo a while, and then go on to Edo. That's only a hunch, though. He never mentioned where he was going. Wouldn't you like some tea?
Musashi waited impatiently, ill at ease in such surroundings, while fresh tea was fetched from the kitchen. When the tea arrived, he asked what Daizo looked like.
Oh, if you see him, you'll recognize him right off. He's 52 years old, quite robust, looks strong, too, a squarish, ruddy face with a few pockmarks. There's a balding spot on his right temple.
How tall is he?
About average, I'd say.
How does he dress?
Now that you ask, I imagine that's the easiest way to recognize him. He's wearing a striped Chinese cotton kimono he ordered from Sakai, especially for this trip. It's a very unusual fabric. I doubt anybody else is wearing it yet.
Musashi formed an impression of the man's character, as well as his appearance. Out of politeness, he lingered long enough to finish the tea. He could not catch up with them before sundown, but he reckoned that if he traveled during the night, he'd be at Shiojiri Pass by dawn and could wait for them there. By the time he came to the foot of the pass, the sun had disappeared, and an evening mist was descending softly over the high road. It was late spring. Lights in the houses along the road emphasized the loneliness of the mountains. It was still 5 miles to the top of the pass. Musashi climbed on, not stopping to relax until he reached Inojigahara, a high, level place hard by the pass. There he lay down among the stars and allowed his mind to wander. It was not long before he was sleeping soundly. The diminutive Sengen Shrine marked the pinnacle of the rocky eminence that stood out like a carbuncle on the plateau. This was the highest point in the Shiojiri area. Musashi's sleep was interrupted by the sound of voices.
"Come up here!" shouted one man. "You can see Mount Fuji!"
Musashi sat up and looked around without seeing anyone. The morning light was dazzling, and there, floating on a sea of clouds, was the red cone of Mount Fuji, still wearing its winter mantle of snow. The sight brought a childish cry of delight to his lips. He had seen paintings of the famous mountain and had a mental image of it, but this was the first time he had actually seen it. It was nearly 100 miles away, but seemed to be on the same level as he was.
"Magnificent," he sighed, making no effort to wipe the tears from his unblinking eyes.
He felt awed by his own tininess, saddened by the thought of his insignificance in the vastness of the universe. Since his victory at the Spreading Pine, he had secretly dared to think there were few, if any, men as well qualified as he was to be called great swordsmen. His own life on earth was short, limited, the beauty and splendor of Mount Fuji eternal. Annoyed and a little depressed, he asked himself how he could possibly attach any importance to his accomplishments with the sword. There was an inevitability in the way nature rose majestically and sternly above him. It was in the order of things that he was doomed to remain beneath it. He fell on his knees before the mountain, hoping his presumptuousness would be forgiven, and clasped his hands in prayer, for his mother's eternal rest and for the safety of Otsu and Jotaro. He expressed his thanks to his country and begged to be allowed to become great, even if he could not share nature's greatness. But even as he knelt, different thoughts came rushing into his mind. What had made him think man was small? Wasn't nature itself big only when it was reflected in human eyes? Didn't the gods themselves come into existence only when they communicated with the hearts of mortals?
Men, living spirits, not dead rock, perform the greatest actions of all. As a man, he told himself, I am not so distant from the gods and the universe. I can touch them with